truetalk.com/how.
Good morning and welcome to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah. We're going to be having a very, very interesting interview today. We're going to be talking to Mustafa Akyol, who is originally from Turkey, and he is the author of two fascinating books, Islam Without Extremes, as well as The Islamic Jesus. Listen to this music. It's a Sufi music, and it's also from Turkey. Enjoy. Back to True Talk. As promised, I'm going to be talking to to author and journalist Mustafa Akyol. He is the author of two fascinating books, Islam Without Extremes, A Muslim Case for Liberty, and the other one that I just finished reading last night is called The Islamic Jesus, How the King of the Jews Became a Prophet of the Muslims. So they are very, very interesting books, they provoked so many questions. So most likely what I will be doing, not take your phone calls, but take your emails to dj@wmnf.org, dj@wmnf.org. This way you can weigh in on the conversation without interrupting this amazing author. Good morning, Mustafa.
Good morning, Samar. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thanks, Mustafa. I just mentioned to our listeners and those of you who are on Twitter, and Mustafa, you can tell your followers that we are transmitting live via Samar Jarrah on Twitter. They can watch us as we speak, and they can also send questions if they have any questions. I will try to check my feed whenever possible. But I just mentioned that you are the author of two different books, but very related: Islam Without Extremes and the Islamic Jesus. Before we go into talking about the books, can you tell us a little bit about your background? Because I've almost never had a Muslim Turk be on the show. And don't type, because we can hear you.
Sure, definitely. First of all, again, thank you for having me on the show, and I'm glad we can speak about my books, and thanks for reading them. My first book, I've written several books in Turkish, my own language. I'm from Turkey. But my first book in English, Islam Without Extremes, A Muslim Case for Liberty, was published in 2011. And with that book, what I wanted to show, that the idea of freedom, that, you know, individuals should not be coerced against their will, and they should be able to choose their faith and their way of life and pursue their dreams and ideas, which is a very modern idea and a very American idea, in a way, is not alien to the Islamic tradition. I the idea of individuals, their own right to make decisions about.
Okay, Mustafa, for some reason, the connection via Skype should be excellent.
There are more communitarian traditions in Islam. There are some limitations in jurisprudence that we have, like bans on blasphemy or apostasy and things like that are controversial in the modern world today. And I explained that, well, these are actually coming from the very core of Islam. These are jurisprudential decisions that medieval scholars made. Context, and they can be reformed and reinterpreted in the light of the modern age. Freedom, in the sense that individuals should be able to make decisions, lives, and live with them.
Mustafa, it says here that we have a poor connection, and it's from my end, not yours. So what I'm going to do is play some music and maybe call you on the number that you gave me. How about we do that? Because I don't want to miss any part and any segment of the conversation. So to our listeners, this is True Talk on WMNF, and I'm going to play some music until I establish a better connection with our author, Mustafa Akyol.
سيارات أكاذيب ألوان
welcome back to True Talk. We have on the phone this time, I think we shouldn't go to technology, Mustafa, when we are talking about such ancient issues, because Skype didn't sound so clear to me. But we have Mustafa Akyol, who is the author of Islam Without Extremes and the Islamic Jesus, and he was telling us why he intended to write these books. But again, Mustafa, really, I wanted to know your background. You grew up in Ankara, and then you came to the U.S. Just recently, or what? Just for our listeners to know who we are talking to.
Sure. I'm Turkish. I'm from Turkey. I was born in Ankara. I spent most of my life in Istanbul, however, and I used to be a newspaper columnist in Istanbul for more than a decade, and an author of several books in the Turkish language as well. And yes, I'm in the U.S. Right now, based in the U.S., in Wellesley, Massachusetts, since January 2017. I'm based in the Wellesley College here, at an institution called the Freedom Project at Wellesley College.
Do you teach classes on Islam, or what?
I don't teach a class, but I do give lectures to students, and I engage with students on the campus in different ways as guests in the classes, and I do my own research and writing. So the institution hosts me for that.
Okay. What I'm going to do, and let me just give our listeners our email, dj@wmnf.org, dj@wmnf.org. And I want to thank Nicole from Sarasota, because she already sent $25 contribution to True Talk. I appreciate that. From Nicole, in memory of Frank Lamberston. The family is... this is a sympathy to the family from Nicole. But you can send your emails to dj@wmnf.org. And Mustafa had started by telling us why he wrote his book, Islam Without Extremes. It says a Muslim case for liberty. So could you go back to that in case the transmission wasn't clear then, Mustafa?
Sure. Well, I mean, I wrote Islam Without Extremes, a Muslim case for liberty. It was published in 2011. Because mainly today in the world, especially in the Western world, Islam is sometimes seen as an oppressive religion, a religion that, you know, is imposed on individuals through a theocratic government or through institutions called the religion police, and people are forced, you know, women are forced to wear the hijab and so on. There are examples like this, an oppressive interpretation of Islam. They do exist. I'm not going to deny that. But I wanted to go back to the very sources of our faith and try to understand where does freedom stand in Islam and where does the idea of coercion. And I wanted to show that there are strong grounds for the idea of freedom, that individuals being able to make their own decisions about their faith, about their lives. But this was sometimes overshadowed by more authoritarian interpretations that do not come from the Quran or the very core of our faith, but from, you know, historic conditions, from just scholars who live in a different time. And we can renew and reinterpret certain elements in Islamic jurisprudence, like ban on apostasy or blasphemy or imagining women as unequal with men. And these were historic decisions. They were not coming from the divine core of Islam. So that was my main argument.
I want you to talk about the Quran, because you have just mentioned it. And when you lecture, probably like when I do, people assume that the Quran is similar to the Bible. And therefore, they ask us, why don't you remove these verses that talk about fighting or about jihad, about this and that? Can you explain in a nutshell what is the Quran, the nature of it, and how is it similar, but in many ways so different than the Bible?
Sure. Well, I mean, the Bible is actually a complex set of books, so there are different parts of it, and it includes the Old Testament, what's called the Old Testament and the New Testament, and maybe the first five books of what is called the Old Testament are a bit more similar to the Quran. But yes, there are differences. First of all, you said some people ask that certain parts of the Quran should be removed. Well, nobody does that even to the Bible. Nobody thinks that certain chapters of the Bible should be taken out. Bible is there, but how do they interpret that is of course, important. Well, the Quran is what we Muslims believe to be the word of God revealed to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
in a time period of 23 years almost, and it's the word of God, so it is definitely very sacred for us Muslims. However, how do you understand the Quran? How do you interpret it? Is actually a complicated question. There are some verses in the Quran about some battles between Prophet Muhammad and the pagans of Mecca, for example. Those were battles that Muslims had to fight because they had to defend themselves. They were defensive wars, and the verses tell Muslims to be steadfast in the battle or fight with the unbelievers who attack them in the first place, those specific people. Now, so these are kind of historic elements in the Quran. It doesn't mean that those battles are happening today, every day, and we have to go through those specific injunctions. So I believe there are some passages in the Quran that tell something about the particular context of Prophet Muhammad, although we can derive from those passages more eternal messages. Whereas I think other parts of the Quran tell Muslims, specific things that are eternally valid at all times. I mean, why God created us, what kind of a God is he, what are his attributes, how about afterlife? So there are many elements of the Quran, and much of the Quran is related to these faith-related issues. When I see in the Western media, for example, people say, in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, you have the law about stoning women, and they think it's in the Quran. No, it's not in the Quran. A lot of people think that the Quran bans fine art. No, it's not. And because much of Islamic tradition is post-Quranic, it developed with the interpretation of scholars. And much of the controversial issues we see actually in Islamic law is not directly coming from the Quran.
We'll talk about that later, but it's important to mention the Quran and the other aspect of where we derive our calls that later became known as Sharia, where people always talk about Sharia, and we are trying to spread it here in America and force Americans to follow Sharia. So other than the Quran, we follow the tradition of Muhammad. And you say in your book that when Islam came, it disrupted the status quo of Arabia. It changed their lives forever. It wasn't a very easy change. It didn't happen very easily for Muhammad. Can you tell us, what did Islam bring to the society where it became, it changed everything about the fabric of that society then?
Yeah. It changed many things, at the very least. I mean, and a lot of things, I can say. Well, before Islam, Arabs were a polytheist people. So, in other words, they believed in many gods. The Kaaba, the building that we worship, towards we worship. We don't worship Kaaba, but when we worship God today, which is, of course, the most sacred mosque in Islam. It was a pagan pantheon, so there were more than 300 idols in the Gaza, and Arabs were worshipping these idols. And Islam basically came as a call for monotheism. It came with the call that there's only one God, the God of Abraham. So it actually continued what people sometimes call the Judeo-Christian tradition, against a polytheistic pagan, cultural setting. So La ilaha illallah, there's no God but the God. That was the key message of Islam. Besides paganism, though, the Arabs had another feature which was linked with paganism, and that was tribalism. The Arabs were divided into tribes, and tribes really defined your existence. As an individual, you didn't have any role, any importance. Your importance, your place in society was defined by what tribe you belong to. And if you were from a stronger tribe, you would be a more important person, a stronger, more protected person. And if you were coming from a lower tribe, you would be seen as a downtrodden. And Islam changed that as well. So actually, tribalism resurfaced in Islamic societies again and again, because it's really hard to change some habits in society. But Islam proclaimed that all believers are equal and tribes do not matter. And also, therefore, in my book, I argue that actually Islam brought the idea of the individual to the Arabs. It brought the idea that individuals have a destiny beyond the tribe, and they will go to God and be judged in afterlife as individuals by their own sins and virtues. So it brought the idea of individual responsibility. And Islamic law brought the idea of individual, again, responsibility in law. And if you committed a crime, only you would be responsible, not other members of your tribe. And, so that's also a new thing.
Is it also the salvation for me is individualistic? Like, my salvation is not via Muhammad or via any entity except my worship and belief in God, but also my duty to the society.
Exactly.
Or humankind.
Exactly. I mean, individual salvation is very much emphasized in the Quran. I mean, the term individual is not maybe necessarily used, but we're told in the Quran that when we die, we're not going to vanish. So, tribes will vanish, nations will vanish, everything on earth will vanish. But individuals, the human beings that God created, they will not disappear. They will be, resurrected by God in the afterlife, and then they will be judged. And they will be judged only based on their individual merits or sins. And it will not be a collective punishment or collective judgment. Your family, your tribe, your nation is not going to matter. So it will be who you are. And there, I believe, I see a theology that really empowers the idea of the individual against tribalism of any sort.
Let me just remind our listeners, they can send us questions to dj@wmnf.org if they have any questions to Mustafa Akyol, who is the author of Islam Without Extremes, A Muslim Case for Liberty. I'm going to be talking about this book for another 10 minutes and then shift to the other book, The Islamic Jesus, which I find it extremely fascinating. But I want to talk, Mustafa, about something you allude to and we always mention, and it's the golden age of the Islamic era. You mentioned Ibn Sina, Ibn al-Ghazali, al-Kandari, Ibn Khaldun. You mention people that even the West recognizes their name, maybe in the English language. Why were they more liberal and more open-minded? And why it ended?
Indeed, there is a golden age of Islam, as it is often called. In my book, I have a chapter on that titled The Enlightenment of the Orient. And that is like the first five centuries of Islam. It begins with the Umayyads, but mostly during the Abbasid Caliphate, which is like 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th centuries. When you look at the world at the time, you see the Islamic civilization as really the most progressed civilization, especially when compared with the West. The biggest libraries on earth were not in London or Paris, but they were in Cordoba or Baghdad or Damascus, which are, you know, Islamic capitals. Islamic cities were more clean, polished, and there were street lights in Muslim Cordoba, which was fascinating for other people to see. Muslims had more discoveries, and as you said, there were great Muslim thinkers, Al-Farabi, Al-Kindi, Ibn Sina, who's also known as Avicenna, and in Spain, there was, of course, Ibn Rushd, Averroes, whose ideas influenced Western tradition, whose ideas influenced Thomas Aquinas and brought a more rationalistic perspective to philosophy, to theology itself. So we lost that age. And interestingly, some of the ideas, some of the more rational philosophical ideas that actually influenced and led the Islamic Golden Age, they died out or they were marginalized in the Muslim world, and they rather flourished in the West and led to the Renaissance and ultimately the Enlightenment and gave us what we call liberal modernity today. Why that happened? Well, that's a huge question, and I have,
maybe in a minute. Yeah.
But I just can say, there was certainly more freedom of thought in that era in Islam compared to some later eras. You would have Muslim philosophers of all different kinds. You would have different Muslim sects, Sunni, Shia, different colors of Sunni Islam. So they were engaging with each other. They were having conversations. They were writing refutations against each other, but that was intellectual vitality. The more Islam became uniform, that one idea dominated everywhere, our intellectual vitality certainly declined, and with that, the whole civilizational energy declined.
As some people in the West say, maybe the solution for the Arab world or the Muslim world is a more secular world or secularism and pushing it and pushing democratization. What do you think is the solution for an Islamic revival? Do you think like going secularism or the separation of state and church is the answer?
Well, secularism can mean different things. And if by secularism, if we imply defining the state as not religious, but with an equal distance to different religions, I'm sympathetic to that. But by secularism, if you mean, oh, religion should be totally pushed out from society, people should not think in terms of religion, well, that is not an idea that I'm sympathetic to. That is in itself authoritarian. You know, that notion of authoritarian secularism led to also many problems in the Muslim world. In Turkey, it led to the banning of the headscarf, for example, on the campus or in state institutions, which is as authoritarian as imposing, you know, the headscarf on women. What we need is to go through our own roots. What we need is to go through our own tradition and find the ideas today which we can use to nurture a, yes, more democratic and more liberal understanding of Islam. But they don't have to be against the religion. They don't have to be secular in the sense that they should come from totally irreligious sources. We have sources within Islam to, you know, revitalize ourselves. So we should have a conversation about those things. And I am sympathetic to the secular state because I think the more state is defined through religion, it becomes a coercive model. So that's wrong. But also by secularism, I don't mean taking religion out of society. That's not the kind of secularism I endorse.
So let's say if we want to have an open debate and start to question Sahih al-Bukhari or evaluation of the hadith, I think there is a project of hadith going on in Turkey, you will find that there are the taboos that are very difficult to penetrate, and you will find sometimes the government itself, authoritarian systems, that will prevent a more open-minded conversation. And I'm not saying changing anything, but just to have a conversation like you and I are having a conversation now. And you say in the book, which I find it very interesting, that Sharia, which the West is afraid from, not all of it, but some people, Islamophobes, you say it protects from tyranny and from authoritarian. How does Sharia, that has such a negative connotation in the West, you think is a protection and is for the people and protects the rights of people, especially when it comes to us trying to reevaluate these ancient taboos?
Sure. I mean, I think what we need is to bring nuance to these concepts. There are certainly some implications, some certain ways of applying Sharia today that are also very offensive to me. I don't want to live in a kind of a Saudi or Iranian or Sudanese kind of so-called Sharia-based society where, you know, individuals are coerced and, you know, heretics are flogged or imprisoned and so on. So there are bad examples of the implementation of Sharia. We should acknowledge that. And maybe some people in the West see that and they have a bleak picture. But yes, we should not allow that bleak picture because, yes, Sharia is a nuanced concept. And when we look at the history of Islam, we see something else. We see something more bright about the Sharia, which is that it acted as what we would call rule of law today. Sharia was never the rule of the sultan, the rule of the ruler. It actually was believed to be, you know, given by God, and scholars developed the whole idea of Sharia. They discovered, if you will, the injunctions of it, which was, and that effort was called, of course, jurisprudence or fiqh. And most important thing is that because Sharia was independent from the state, from the power, it protected society sometimes from the state. For example, one of the contributions of Sharia in Islamic societies is that it protected property from the ruler. If you had wealth, you could establish a foundation, a waqf, as it's called in Arabic, and the sultan couldn't touch that because that's protected by God's law. That allowed Islam to develop a civil society in the Middle Ages, whereas it was the norm for, you know, sultans and kings or princes to come and usurpate whatever they wanted because they had unlimited power. So Sharia was a check on the executive, as we would call today. So that kind of tradition is something we should revive and bring today to the Muslim world. although we should understand that some aspects of Sharia have to be rethought and reinterpreted because they wouldn't fit into what we understand as human rights today.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF, and I'm talking to Mustafa Akyol, and at the moment we are discussing his book, Islam Without Extremes. In a few minutes, we're going to shift the conversation and talk about the Islamic Jesus. I have a question that I just got about the caliphate. A question is it a requirement? Is it like the one of the things that can complete and create a utopian society? That is it a duty for every Muslim to seek and to have a caliphate?
Well, people have different answers on that. My answer is no, it is not a requirement. Why it is not a requirement? Because the Quran doesn't speak of a caliphate. There's no institution called caliphate in the Quran. Actually, in the Quran, the term caliphate exists. But it has nothing to do with the political institution we know. It's about the mandate God has given to every individual, you know, being a vicegerent of God on earth. So that's a metaphysical concept in the Quran. The Prophet Muhammad didn't speak of caliphate because, he was the ruler of the Muslim community. He was the head of the Muslim community. He didn't say much about what would happen after him. And I think that was very wise. The caliphate was born when Prophet Muhammad passed away, and Muslims came together and said, what are we going to do now? So they decided to choose a successor to Prophet Muhammad, and that's how the idea of a caliphate was born. It was a human decision. It was a decision of the Muslim community. So I consider caliphate as a part of the Islamic civilization and its historical experience, but I don't think it's something that has to be repeated in every time and age. I think governance in Islam is not strictly defined by religion, and it can change from society to society. In the modern age, we can certainly live in democratic republics or constitutional monarchies, and there doesn't have to be an institution called the caliphate.
I'm sure, Mustafa, when you also give these lectures and classes, people assume that Islam is Arab. And because, the Quran is revealed in the Arabic language, and for you to read the Quran or to do, for instance, the Hajj or to do prayer, the Salah, you have to say the verses not in the English or Turkish language, but in Arabic. People assume that Islam is Arab. However, most Muslims are not Arab, like most Muslims in America are not Arab. Is there a different Islam or another way of approaching Islam that is uniquely Turkish, for instance, that is different than the Arab countries' approach to Islam or how they deal with it?
Good question. Certainly. There are different traditions in Islam, and those traditions are partly defined by the ethnic or national background. The tradition of Islam in Turkey is there are universal aspects of it, obviously, but also there are regional variations, if you will. Islam in Indonesia is, somewhat different from Islam in Turkey or in Bosnia, let's say, or in Yemen or, Morocco. Of course, all Muslims read the same Quran, the text of the Quran is the same, the basic texts are the same, but when you put them into life, put them into practice, put them into culture, a lot of regional backgrounds interplay with these texts, and they create a whole colorful picture. And that is inevitable. That's only normal. And I think the more Muslim societies interact with each other, maybe they can learn from different things from each other, and they can understand that what we have today as the Islamic tradition is also like a combination of texts, but also cultures. And those cultures can be changed, and those cultures can be preferred or criticized, and it's human production.
Finally, to conclude talking about this book, your last chapter, Freedom to Sin, I'm not sure how Muslims will take that. Could you explain what is it you're trying to say
sure.
Freedom to Sin?
Sure, I have a chapter titled The Freedom to Sin. I know it's provocative and intentionally so, because I wanted Muslims to think about this matter. There, I'm critical of the institution called the religion police that we have in Saudi Arabia, and we have similar institutions in Iran, even in Malaysia, there's something called the Religion Enforcement Police, and I got into trouble with them like a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Not because of any sin, but because of a conference I gave in Malaysia. So that's a story in itself. But what I'm saying is that there are things Islam considers as sin, like drinking alcohol, right? Or not fasting in Ramadan without a good reason, or not doing your daily prayers, or eating pork. Or there are things that, like every religion, Islam defines certain things, like most religions, as sinful. Now, the question is this sin something that the believer will restrain from based on his or her own conscience and piety? Or is it something that will be checked by the government, by society, which will be punished by outside? In other words, not drinking alcohol, is this about an individual Muslim saying, no, I'm not going to drink, thank you, but it's out there, it's available? Or is it about banning it for a whole society and punishing people if they have a bottle of alcohol in their bag or something, which is the case in Saudi Arabia? I am saying that sin should not be punished by the state or society. It is between individual and God. And if people commit sin, it's their problem, and we should, as good Muslims, counsel against that, advise against that. But it is not a crime in itself. Of course, some sins are crimes. I mean, theft is a sin and a crime because you harm other person. But if somebody is committing a sin, it should be between him and God. And otherwise, it would lead to hypocrisy, not piety. If you force people to be pious, quote-unquote, you're making them more hypocritical. And this is the basic argument. And, of course, I go through the Quran and I go through Islamic law to make this argument, and I show how I can make it. But that's the basic idea there.
It's very interesting, but I really want to go to the Islamic Jesus. So how about we take a minute break, give you 1 minute, Mustafa, of a break. I'm going to play this Sufi music for deep meditation. And this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM. We are transmitting live on Twitter, and you can send us questions to dj@wmnf.org. I'm going to play a little bit of music, give Mustafa a break, and then we're going to be right back.
Yeah.
And welcome back to True Talk. This was Sufi music for deep meditation. And we are going to continue the conversation with author Mustafa Akyol. Now we're going to be talking about his book, The Islamic Jesus, How the King of the Jews Became a Prophet of the Muslim. It's a very, very in-depth kind of reading. I read it. I spent all of yesterday reading it, which is not fair, really, because I wanted to contemplate every chapter. It's full of stories, but I think I should say from the beginning, Mustafa, what shocked me the most is that there is so much out there that we need to read and learn. So, how long did it take you to write this book, and why did you write, as a Muslim, The Islamic Jesus?
Well, first of all, thank you for reading the book, you know, for having these very kind words about it. I think it took me maybe 2 years to fully write the book, but then there's a decade behind that of, you know, thinking about these issues and having some kind of research on Christianity and Islam, because I've been always fascinated by theology. And I studied early Christianity way back in the early 2000s, but couldn't write about it. Then, you know, came this opportunity. Why did I write this book? Well, honestly, it was partly inspired by my friend Reza Aslan, who also has a nice blurb on the book. You know, he says this is a great book and, you know, you should read it. We put it on the cover. Reza wrote this book, Zealot, in 2014 or 2013, if I'm not wrong. And it was a very successful book. It was very interesting for a lot of Americans. Oh, a Muslim is writing a book about Jesus. That's very interesting. But he did not write a book about Jesus from the Islamic perspective. It was just a historical evaluation of who Jesus was. And his conclusion was that he was maybe a zealot, in other words, a Jewish, you know, fighter against Roman rule in first century Palestine, and nothing much sacred in that sense. And I said, well, that's interesting, very good book by Reza, but maybe someone should write how Islam really understands Jesus. So I wanted to write the Islamic Jesus, not just merely the historic Jesus, as some people call that tradition. Then, and I also wanted to just not explain how the Quran or the Hadith describe Jesus, and there are a few good books out there which have done that already. I wanted to show how Islam's understanding of Jesus resonates with certain Christian traditions, and what can we make about that connection. That is actually the most interesting, I think, part of the book, and that's a big part of the book anyway.
That's almost the first few chapters, and that's where really I was so much engrossed in the book and could not put it away. When you you know, you talk about Jesus, and we believe this, that Jesus came to the Jews. He did not come to a community that existed, that was hoping for another religion, that he came to complete the message of Judaism, that he was a Jew himself, and that there were Christians later on after the crucifixion. And then, of course, we have our own theory of crucifixion. But then you go in depth about the two different Christianities out there that probably some people listening don't even know that it existed, which is, you call them the Jewish Christians, I think. And then there is Paul, who was fighting those people who believed in Jesus, but then saw something and he completely created a different religion. Can you just mention that briefly, because I'm going to use it to move into the Muslim Jesus.
Yeah, here's the basic idea. I mean, we as Muslims believe in Jesus in a very interesting way. We disagree with the Jews, and we say Jesus was the Messiah. I mean, the Quran describes Jesus as the Messiah. You know, Judaism has this notion of Messiah. Jews are still waiting for the Messiah. Jews don't accept Jesus as a prophet, they accept as one of them themselves, but not someone significant. Christians, of course, accept Jesus. They venerate Jesus, but they worship him. They see him as, you know, God incarnate, and we don't accept that either. So we are somewhere between Judaism and Christianity when it comes to the matter of Jesus. We respect him, we adore him, but we do not worship him, and we see him as a prophet, not as God. Now, my case in the book is that there were people in early Christianity who saw Jesus exactly like that. We know this from the own sources of Christianity. They are called by academics as Jewish Christians. These were Jews who believed in Jesus as the Messiah that they'd been waiting. They kept on being Jews, so they kept the kosher laws. They still practiced circumcision, so they were still Jewish, and they didn't think that they were belonging to another religion called Christianity. But they just accepted Jesus as a prophet and Messiah. And with Paul, of course, Christianity just began to evolve into a different religion. It was born as a different religion, which detached itself from Judaism and, of course, saw Jesus as God incarnate. And my argument in the book is that our understanding of Jesus as Muslims, the Quranic definition of Jesus, is very similar to those early Christians called Jewish Christians. Of course, this has been noticed by some Western scholars as well. That's why there's a literature on this. I mean, is there a connection between Islam and Jewish Christianity? They assume that, you know, Islam might have got this idea from Jewish Christianity. I mean, I discuss their theories on that. Of course, my feeling is that Islam got this idea from nowhere but from God, from the Revelation. But my book is a study, is research on this intriguing connection between Jewish Christianity and Islam and how we can interpret it in different ways.
Did this group of people disappear, or did they remain in history? Do they exist now?
They disappeared. I mean, we know that they exist actually from the church fathers, the Catholic church fathers, the mainstream Christians, who wrote about them as heretics. There are books by early church fathers written in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries, and they define, oh, these are the heretics in our faith. I mean, we have similar texts in Islam about the, you know, so-called heresies in early Islam. And they said, oh, there are these people, they think they believe in Christ, but they are actually Jews, and they don't accept his divinity. So they renounce them as heretics. And they're called Ebionites, for example, a Hebrew term which means the poor. Some of them are called Nazarenes, a term which probably comes from Nazareth, you know, where Jesus was from, but there are controversies about it. So we know that there were these heretical Christians, quote-unquote, whose ideas are very much like that of Islam. But they were branded as heresies, and they vanished from history. I mean, that's what we know. But I'm saying, well, they did not vanish. Their ideas actually continue in Islam, and that's why is that is a very interesting question.
You started the talk about Jesus and Islam with the chapter on Mary and her baby. And let me just read from your book, the Quran chapter 21, verse 31. Remember the one who guarded her chastity. We breathed into her from our spirit and made her and her son a sign for all people. Mary was mentioned 34 times in the Quran, I think more than she was mentioned in the New Testament, and of course more than any woman. And there is a whole chapter called After Her. Why did you start the story of Jesus in the Quran with his mother? How significant and important, and how different is it from the Bible?
Well, I mean, it is really significant that Mary is the woman given most attention in the whole Quran. Actually, she's the only woman mentioned by her name. She's defined as a woman that God elevated above all other women. So she's so holy. And the Quran tells how she gave birth to Jesus without a biological father. She was a virgin. Nobody touched her. She was a very pious, godly woman. And one day, angel Gabriel came. The Quran doesn't say Gabriel, but it's, you know, assumed that way. An angel came and said, you will have a son, despite that no man touched you. And she's surprised, but she has a son, and it's Jesus. So the Quran confirms what is called the virgin birth, which is actually one of the core beliefs in Christianity. So the Quran confirms a part of Christianity right there, and it's very interesting. But of course, the Quran then criticizes Christians and says, but this doesn't mean Jesus is God. And interestingly, there were Jewish Christians who believed exactly this way. They believed that Jesus was born of a virgin without a father, but they didn't think that this meant Jesus is divine. So I showed that connection. And of course, I want to show Muslims and Christians that our religions are different, and there are some obvious gaps, but also there are some important similarities that which we can understand and appreciate.
So how do you answer Christians who say, yeah, but this is a fundamental difference? Okay, yes, we all, all prophets wanted to embetter humanity, and you value the mother and, all that. But this is that's like an extremely fundamental difference between accepting Jesus as the salvation.
I would say two things. First of all, yes, but even Christians themselves disagreed on the nature of Jesus profoundly, especially in the first centuries of Christianity. I mean, in Christian history, there are many Christian groups, sects, that rejected the doctrine of Trinity, for example. They said it's not even written in the Bible. So even Christians have different ideas about the exact nature of Jesus. So why don't you also look at Islam and its own perspective? I would say that. Secondly, despite the big gaps between Judaism and Christianity, Jews and Christians have been able to develop a more amenable, friendly attitude in the past century. It was not there before, but especially after the Second World War. Now people speak of a Judeo-Christian tradition. And that is, despite the fact that the gap between Judaism and Christianity on the matter of Jesus is huge. For Christians, Jesus is God incarnate. He's there, the most important figure in their religion. And Jews don't accept him at all. I mean, as a prophet or as a sacred. I mean, there are some Jews who, of course, have reinterpreted and show more respect for Jesus than the common. But in Judaism, Jesus is not a holy figure. Well, in Islam, there's actually a smaller gap between Islam and Christianity when it comes to Jesus. So if we can speak of a Judeo-Christian tradition, we should imagine speaking of a Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition as well. Our religions are not that distant.
Two things strike me when I'm reading this. One, that I don't know much, although I consider myself a reader because, oh my gosh, there are several modern authors that you mentioned that I Googled and wanted to read more about. But there are two things that strike me from reading. All this is happening. I mean, everything about Christianity and Judaism, 90% of it is happening or happened or remained happening later on in the heart of these Islamic civilizations where they were conquering the whole world. They kept the churches, they kept the synagogues, they kept the Bible, they kept the Torah, they kept the priests, they kept the rabbis. I mean, couldn't Muhammad just tell them, hey guys, you need to convert to Islam or I'm going to kill you? I mean, why can't the West see this amazing historical phenomena that you had an extremely dominant religion and all this legacy was kept? One thing. The other thing is, how can atheists or people like Sam Harris keep attacking religion and asking us to totally negate it or get rid of it, and yet there is so much history that is physically there you can visit? How can we have like a minute and a half, Mustafa? Did I lose Mustafa? Hello? Oh gosh, I can't believe it.
I hear you now.
Okay, thank God. Okay.
What you're saying is very true. I mean, Islam actually was the most tolerant religion in the pre-modern era, where, the idea of democracy, human rights, they were not on the horizon. And it was the norm in the pre-modern era to force people to convert. I mean, Christians forced Jews to be Christians in many episodes in history. That's why Jews had to flee Spain, for example, in the 15th century. Islam didn't do that because Islam said, okay, here's the final, the most perfect religion, but Christianity and Judaism, they're valid as well. They're God's religion. They're based on scriptures that God sent. So Christians and Jews can worship and practice their religion. And that was an incredibly, tolerant thing to do at the time. That's why we have
We have 45 seconds, Mustafa, sorry.
Yeah, we have Arab Christians, we have Oriental Jews, as they were called. And unfortunately, those minorities in the Middle East suffered more so in the past century than before because of nationalism and this recent wave of fundamentalism, which we didn't have before. So yes, we should recognize that tolerant history of Islam, and we should see the theological framework that allows that. And that framework is that Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, these are Abrahamic religions. They have lots in common. And we should see that commonality partly in the Last of Jesus, and that's why I wrote the Islamic Jesus.
Maybe we will deal with the other part of my question later on. I want to thank Mustafa Akyol, the author of Islam Without Extremes and the Islamic Jesus, for being on True Talk. This is WMNF 88.5 FM, and this is NPR News. Live.